So, yes, today is a Q&A. So I have some questions that have been submitted in the past that are over here in an envelope, and we often have somebody just draw one randomly. But I also just like to open it up to anybody who's present, the dirt or the cloud, to any questions that you would like us to like me to address that you would just kind of like the Sangha to discuss. And they can be practical. You'd be like, why do we do that? What's that chant thing that we do? It could be very, practical. It can be about the teachings, about Zazen, about practice in daily life. Yes, Courtney.
So I find myself curious about the readings that are in the booklet that we get and how those were chosen and why those particular ones
Like the
are
chant book?
like the chant book.
Yeah. Good question. So, just remind me, good question. You ever notice, like, on talk shows or whatever, like, that no matter what the question is, everybody says, oh, good question. It's like, when it's like, well, that was kind of a lame question that I guess. So she's talking about our chant book, Bright Ways In chant book, which if you become a member, we send one of these to you. You're just in your little member welcome packet. It's also available as a PDF on the website. And when we're doing chanting, the cloud host will paste a link to the PDF chant book for a cloud folks. And I mean, theoretically, if you're not a member, I guess you could pay us some money and we could send it to you, but we'd love for you to become a member. Yes. Now Peter got his. Yes, okay, great. In here we have instructions for Zazen that I wrote. My name's on there. And we have short verses. We have two full chanting services that we alternate between, and they have different chants within them. So there's the harmony of difference and sameness. We chant the line of ancestors, the Makkahanya Haramita Shingyo. So it would take the rest of this class to go through and explain where all of these came from. So let's see, how should I do it?
Just generally, like what
Yeah,
set
kind
what's
of.
included, how were they chosen?
Yeah. I'm just thinking of, like, so what at what level am I gonna slice it? Because I could probably do a whole Dharma talk on it. I could do a whole Dharma talk on pretty much every one of these chants. I could do a whole class series on actually most of the chants. So what is really cool to realize, and I was actually brainstorming during Zazen, sorry, that I thought, I wonder if James would want to search out, like, YouTube video of chanting services in Japan. Like Soto Zen chanting services in Japan. I know they exist. I know I've seen them. I want to see, like, the video of, like, the full, you got a whole bunch of monks doing all the choreography and all that. Because what's really cool is when you see that and you recognize what we do is, and it's not just an echo of it, but we're doing the same thing. It looks very different. We're in English and we don't have it all choreographed. We all don't spend 8 hours a day training to, do all these ceremonial things. But the chants are the same. And they're, if you can recognize the Sino-Japanese that they're chanting in and realize some of them we have translated. And that's been quite a process over the last 50, 60, 70 years, is translating that and translating the chants in a way that make they're still chantable. Because Japanese is very, very different. And like the Mokugyo goes for like, they either have one syllable characters or they have two syllable characters. And it's a very, that's, very, makes a lot of sense. Or in English, it's much more awkward. And actually, my teacher, Kyogen, had come up with a way where they kind of, if you ever go to Dharma Rain, it sounds almost syncopated, where he chose some syllables, two syllable parts of words, which would just be on one beat. So they would visit the great sage of India, but anyway, and I just dropped on that to be simpler again. So you listen to these chants, and you listen to, like, today in service B, we did a Dharani, which was the Daishin Dharani, Namu Kara Tanno Dharaya Ya Namu Arya, which this is why I put our chant service at the very beginning of our day, so that people don't have to come to it. Because Dharma Rain does it, like, you come to two periods of sitting and then you do chanting if you want to stick around for socializing in the talk. And I feel like this is, I don't know, like, this can be a bit much for people, right? And that, like, what is this? I mean, if you have any misgivings about religion, organized religion, or anything like that, you're not, now you're just chanting nonsense, nonsense syllables. You don't even know what you're chanting.
Are we chanting?
Yoli's like, what are we chanting? So a Dharani in particular is, it's said to be a chant that is so old that we don't even necessarily know it. We kind of know what it means, but this goes all the way back to India, where the belief is not, it's not so much of a Buddhist thing, it's more of a cultural and pan-religious thing, where it's the very sound of the syllables that have the power. So that through from India to China to Japan to here, we try to keep it all like the same. We just transliterate it into our own alphabet and keep it the same. So that would be, so in a sense, keeping this in our service might be a little dicey for brand new people. But on the other hand, when James finds the video and audio and brings it in, and we could do that as a whole like Sunday presentation, you will hear these Japanese monks chanting Namu Kara Tanno Dharaya, and be like, I know that one, and you'll if we find any video from Chinese monasteries, we're going to hear them chanting that. So it's kind of like, I remember when I first encountered this stuff, I was like, my teacher's Kyogen and Gyokuko. I'm like, they didn't make this stuff up. I mean, all I knew, I didn't know. Like, did they just make this stuff up? I mean, we have a meal chant in here, and that, that is the same. It's been the same for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So there's a real history in this. Great.
Sorry, I didn't know if this was appropriate time to ask, but that Dharani, so there's no literal translation to that, and if not, is there like a mean, is there like a purpose that it's supposed to, or a feeling it's supposed to evoke?
Yes. So it's like kind of what's passed down is the purpose. So this is the great disaster preventing Dharani, I believe. And the Shosa, or is it,
Daishin Duran, it's the protection.
this is the protection. What's the Shosaimyo Kichijo? Do you remember?
One of them is fire.
Yeah, but
with the Kichijo, right? It's like a fall up to that, or it's like a,
well, that was translatable.
I don't know, but there, here's the thing, is that even though they're difficult to translate, and when you translate, I mean, even translating straightforward texts is difficult. So translating a Dharani is difficult. But I believe that the litany of the great compassionate one is kind of an homage to the Dahitian Dharani. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I have a terrible memory, but they do have one. What's the one that Great Vow translates as, like, just like the great bodhisattva boundless is boundless compassion is nothing but compassion.
Ten line Avalokiteshvara.
This is the last
So
10 major good.
the Enmei Juku Kanangyo is another Dharani, but then that some people sometimes it's translated. So
They translated it back to Sanskrit and then from there translated it forward.
right, Chinese.
Yes, Peter. Oh.
No.
It's the lowering the hand and then trying to hit the audio is always a problem. I don't know if we're ready to move to a different question, but I have a
Oh,
so. Or we can.
no, I have a lot more to say on this, but so hold it. So, but hold your question for sure. Okay, so the Enmei Juku Kanengyo is actually on page 4, Kanzei Yanamu Butsu Yo Butsu Uin. Okay. In particular, I think I did a Dharma talk on some of this at one point. I don't think I've done a podcast episode, but the harmony of difference and sameness and the precious mirror samadhi are both teaching poems from China, from Chinese Chan, that are greatly significant in our school. So they're always incorporated into morning chanting services of Soto Zen in Soto Zen communities. So there's books on both of them. And yeah, then we chant the line of Dharma ancestors from Shakyamuni. The Makka Hanya Haramita Shingyo, which is on page 11, is the Heart Sutra. It's the somebody who'd been around for quite a while was like, oh really? Like, okay, it doesn't say that anywhere. So the heart on page 22. So on one of our morning chanting services, we do it in English, and the other morning chanting service, we do it in Sino-Japanese. So Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, that's the Heart Sutra in English. And then the Makka Hanya Haramita Shingyo is in Sino-Japanese. And again, there'd be a good argument for just doing it in English and not doing it in Sino-Japanese because it's, it could be like weird. But then you're going to hear these, and other communities. And there's many different translations of this, of the Heart Sutra. So you go to a different, different temple, different lineage, different place, and they're going to be chanting it differently. But if you chant it in Sino-Japanese, this is exactly what you're going to chant. And that's only the case because the Japanese got organized, right? The Japanese Sotoshu is every bit as organized and bureaucratic as the Catholic Church, right? It's got levels, it's got organization, it's got training, it's got standardization, it's got requirements and all that. So that's good and bad, right? That's like it can get institutionalized and kind of boring. But on the other hand, that's kind of sweet. Like wherever you go, you're going to be able to chant the same chant. Did I see some hands coming up? The Universal Gateway of Compassion is on page 12, and we incorporate that into service A, and that's another one that is always if you go to the Japanese Soto Shu website, so they actually have the Japanese Soto Shu means school, the Japanese Soto school website. So they have a beautiful, beautiful English website for us. They have a beautiful English website for
How do you spell shoe?
SHU. The beautiful website for their There's Soto Shu temples who are now not in Japan. And yeah, I guess you could hand out chant books if people want to look. They have a Soto Shu scriptures for daily practice. So they have that on the website, and there's PDFs, and you'll see that the PDFs in that Soto Shu scripture book are also, pretty much everything that we have in here, including Fukan Zazengi. You can actually, I actually have a physical copy of that book, and it's made like a accordion style book. Have you seen those Japanese books? There's like two covers. You could open the covers like that, and then there's like accordion paper in between, so that, and essentially you can read it this way, and then you can flip it over and you can read it, the backside. And it's just tell a little story about that. So the English takes a lot more space to write than Japanese. So the monks, the Japanese monks, have these little chant books,
Oh, yes.
and they put them right here in their robe, right? So like you, it's a little chant book, and when you're not using it, when you're going to make a bow or something, you can put it right there. And so when I went over for a big ceremony in Japan, they gave us these, English versions of the chant book, which is very sweet, right? But they're big and heavy. So you can like stuff them in your robe, but you got this giant book in there, and then when you do a bow, it kind of wants to fall out. Anyway, so that universal gateway of compassion is based on one of the chapters of the Lotus Sutra. And this is an abridged version of it. And I took the liberty of abridging it. I was inspired by my Dharma Uncle James Ford, because I wasn't going to include it in our chant book or a chant at all, except that I saw what he did and I was like, oh, I could do that. So this is where I did make a judgment call in terms of, if this was your first time here, what would you think? Because the full chapter has a whole bunch of stuff about calling on con that could just, if an enemy is attacking you with a sword, just call on Kanzeon and their sword will break. If you are in prison, in chains, just call Kanzeon's name and those chains will be broken and you will be set free. If somebody throws you from a cliff, call Kanzeon's name and you will be borne aloft, and all kinds of like really magical stuff. And I even like replaced Kanzeon's name with compassion a lot. She's mentioned a few times, but then it's more just kind of, I go on the whole more like archetype, right? The archetype of compassion. Compassion is very powerful and transformative. So that way we could include it and not, I'd be just too weird the first time somebody shows up.
Never listen to the words that I'm chanting. I just chant.
Good for you. Yeah.
So weird that you're saying all this. I'm going, what's she talking about?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It would definitely be worth studying these things. And I did have it on my list of, possible classes to study one of the texts. Jessica, did you mean to raise your hand at some point?
I did. I just had a comment. I know that I actually love it that we do the extended chant service. I was thrilled when I first came to Bright Way because I just love the chanting. And I also really love the chants in Sino-Japanese. The more the better, because it gets me out of my head, just into the chanting, and I feel like it really prepares me for Zazen, especially when the group really gets in sync and we're all kind of in the same space. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Thank you. Ruth Ann, have you been wanting to say something?
Peter.
Ruth Ann.
Sorry, I didn't. I agree. I like the chanting. It was one of the things that pulled me to Buddhism. And I think this is good that we're able to ask a few questions around this. Thanks.
Sure. Alan.
Can I go there?
Yeah, come on up so people can see you a little bit.
Peter had something too, but he
also... Well, Peter's the next question. He's the next topic.
I mean, my question is still related to the chanting, the power of chanting.
Get out for you, Peter.
Yeah.
And how much of it is based on faith? How much is based on experience? And I noticed that in China, there are a lot of Buddhists that don't know much about Buddhism, mm-hmm. but they just chant. Mm-hmm. And then they think that's going to help them to make money, become mm-hmm. more powerful, mm-hmm. whatever.
Good point. Yeah, there's lots of different ways that people have practiced chanting. And Alan was just talking about the there are many, I mean, I'm sure it's not just Buddhism, various forms of religion, but there are forms of Buddhism where just chanting, like kind of like the more you do it, the more the better, and like good and good stuff will happen, right? So that's like I mean, Buddhism is never, not maybe not never, but is rarely dogmatic, right? So if there was somebody in our sangha who really, really felt that, right, who really felt like chanting Kanzeon's name, you know, solicited a response from the universe, there you go. I have actually a couple podcast episodes on prayer in Buddhism and the different ways that it's held. For us, I don't know. I mean, there's so many different levels at which we could engage it. It could just be like this, like Yoli's kind of saying, like, I don't even thinking about it. I'm just, it's more of a physical meditation, right? And Jessica, like, it's just chanting the syllables. It's about breath. One of the things that I loved the best was this, somebody pointing out, a Japanese woman, that if you chant by taking a full breath and chanting as long as you can until the end of the breath, and then, and it doesn't matter if you miss a syllable or two, like, especially if you're chanting with other people, you don't have to, unless you're the chant leader, especially on Zoom, but you can just miss a syllable or two as you inhale, and then, like, actually that calms the body, right? Mm-hmm. It's deep breathing practice. So it's actually a physical practice. But then there's also the level of, you know, these teachings go in, they just kind of go in at a different level. And then at a certain point, some phrase will just kind of pop up and we'll have some insight into it. Like, it's a way to be exposed to the teaching in a not just a intellectual way. Yeah. And then I also think of it as like, this is something we do together. You know, our zazen, we're together, but we're very separate. But then this practice that we do together seems very important for sangha as well. Jill.
I really didn't like chanting when I started, and I really like it now, but I wanted to share, I went to Japan last April, and I had maybe been chanting like 2 months, so not very long. And we went to lots of temples and saw lots of amazing stuff. But there was one temple we went to when they were chanting something I knew. Mm. And it was the most like wild experience. It was totally like unconscious. I just knew it. I almost started saying it with them. And I mean, it just stopped me in my tracks. And it totally kind of reframed how I thought about chanting, because it was so connecting and it was felt very spiritual, and we're at this, you know, ancient old temple. And so that I really appreciate it. And it that was such an amazing experience.
And I've similarly, I've found, I don't know. I mean, I find chanting a little boring. My mind wanders, and I try to keep it on the chanting, but it doesn't, to some extent, that doesn't really matter. Like I've said before, if I am on my deathbed, please come chant for me. You know, that's like, that would be so comforting, just because that's it. It's something that we do, right? It's just something that we do together. And so it doesn't really matter whether we like it or not. Yeah, Yoli.
Well, I just wanted to make a plug. I think I've said this, shared this before, but a plug for science and chanting, which is there's certain consonants and sounds that reverberate and it actually vibrates the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is important in the production of serotonin in the brain. Mm-hmm. So it causes well-being. And so that's been very well studied, actually, using functional MRIs. And one of the things they found is like at least 20 minutes of chanting can actually improve well-being. And they've done studies on this, which is super, super cool. And there's actually a scientific reason why people feel better when they chant. And then when you're talking about the exhale, there's when you slow down your exhales, most people say breathe in and out through your mouth, but when you actually slow down your breath through your nose, it triggers your parasympathetic system. Mm-hmm. And your parasympathetic systems, you have your sympathetic, which is your fight flight, and parasympathetic is the one that slows you down. So there are all of these things, there's actual scientific reasons why we feel better when we do it. I love to chant.
Exhale through the mouth and you'd inhale.
No, exhale through the nose because it slows down your breathing.
Oh, but not while chanting.
No. But you were talking
about a different deal.
You were talking about this
person slows down your exhale too.
Yeah,
chanting slows down your
exhale. Exactly.
But you take a deep breath and then you
chant. So all of that slowing down actually produces. So I mean, I feel always better when I chant. So.
Well, just to continue a little bit in the chant book here, in terms of like what is in there. So, you know, it's very traditional to chant the line of ancestors from Shakyamuni all the way down to like that. If you're on that list, you're dead. So like my teacher's not on that list. but her teacher's on that list. And that's another one that you will hear. Now we say, you know, great teachers, you know, such and such to make it more accessible. But what we will hear when we listen to the Japanese is that in Daiyosho. So it'd be Makakacho, Daiyosho, Ananda, Daiyosho, Shonawashi, Daiyosho. You know, and you'll hear, I don't recognize those names. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then an innovation is that in one of our chanting services, we do that traditional line, which is, all men through like, I think it's around 85 generations until the last one, which is my Dharma grandmother, Ho'un Jiu Kenin. And then we alternate in service B, we have called the line of women Dharma ancestors, which was compiled. This is not a lineage in the same sense of the other one, and that very few of these are like teacher and student. So there is an importance to the other lineage in that it's part of, you know, honoring this Dharma person-to-person Dharma transmission. But frankly, the ladies didn't get to do that, right? We would have probably a lineage of women ancestors if they had been able, which is why we begin the chant by saying, especially diligent and determined were the women ancestors who faced cultural obstacles in their efforts to realize the way. So like if these ladies, you know, practiced and survived the you know, turmoil of history, then they were badass. So I always find this very powerful to chant these. And then of course it ends with my grandmother. Then we have, that's the Heart of Perfect Wisdom Sutra, the Dharanis. And then we have the section of the book, which is our Tuesday recitations. So these are ones that we don't chant musically like that. We just recite out loud together. And those are led by cloud chant leaders. And we have the Bodhisattva precepts, which we are reciting. Those are the moral guidelines of our lineage, and we recite those whenever we're doing precept studies. So for a good, you know, 2.5 months of the year, we recite that. Fukan Zazengi, the universally recommended instructions for Zazen. And we have other, they're almost all kind of instruction, other than the precepts, they're about Zazen. So it's like once, and we cycle through these different readings so that I think there's five of them that we do. And then, you know, we have like a 5-week rota that we do. And so these are all also important. So Dogen, you know, is the founder of Soto Zen in Japan. Keizan is one of his Dharma ancestors, Dharma heirs. Zen Master Hongzhi is a Chan master from China. And we have another Dogen. And we have Faith in Mind from, that's another Chan teaching poem. Then we have the Metta Sutra, which is a Pali canon sutra, which we chant melodically. This is what should be done. So that's kind of beautiful. We have Shantideva's Bodhisattva Vow, which is another one which we chant melodically. And then we have Vespers, the Litany of the Great Compassionate One, and some other ones that are sung. And these come from Roshi Kennett and Shasta Abbey. So my Dharma grandmother was an English woman. She was a trained musician in the Church of England, and probably would have been like a priest or a minister or whatever they call them, except that women couldn't be. She ended up connecting with a Zen teacher from Japan and went to go study with him. And when she founded Shasta Abbey in Northern California, and my teachers studied there, she made some innovations. And she took this kind of atonal chanting that we do, the Japanese style of just like, you know, and we've talked about this before. The style of chanting is like, it's not supposed to be pretty. And that's something that hopefully we can demonstrate with our videos or audio too, of just, it's more of like a drone, and everybody just kind of picks their own resonant tone, right? And if everybody does that just energetically, but it's, you know, it's usually deep, which always makes chanting in mixed groups of men and women is a little tricky, because like, if you have a whole group of women chanting together, usually we chant pretty low, and like men can't quite make it an octave below that. So in order for the, and in order for the men in leading, they have to kind of sing like this in order for us to, you know, it's a little tricky. But basically you choose that resonant tone that's pretty deep in your abdomen, and just do it atonally, which is something that it's easier if you're arriving for the first time. You know, we can all do that together, right? It's pretty straightforward. But the melodies that Roshi Kennett, so it's kind of like plain song, or it is. She set, and she didn't just set this Litany of the Great Compassionate One to plain song. She set all the chants, the Heart Sutra, and they have different titles for them, the Harmony and Difference and Sameness. So the whole shebang would be sung, and it's like adoration to Kanzeon, who is the Great Compassionate One. Om to the one who leaves beyond all fear. And then the cool thing is there's 4-part harmony, which at Shasta Abbey, this is like there's a fairly stable population of monks who live there and practice this. So it sounds lovely. But if you, so like Kyogen and Gyokoko tried to keep it that way at Dharma Rain for a while, and then it was like, no, ain't happening. Like, it just sounded just terrible. So, but we break them out at certain times and certain ceremonies we do. We'll break out one of these chants that is set to plain song, and it's kind of sweet. I mean, I think many of us who have, if you have any kind of positive association with other religious traditions, that's usually part of it, right? Kind of miss the singing. And then yeah, then there's our formal meal verse, which similarly is like very, very old and traditional. And then there's adoration of the Buddha's relics, which is another of Roshi Kenneth's hymns, which we break out sometimes. So it's a quick once over of the chant book. Now we have 10 minutes. So I don't know, Peter, is yours how big a bite is it?
I think it's quick, but I'm also willing to let somebody else talk if they'd rather. It's
No,
okay.
go ahead. No, go ahead. You.
I just note real quick that I've been doing a bit of a deep dive on the chants because as a new member, I'm curious about the history, and it's actually really interesting to know that the innovation moving away from Shasta Abbey's plain song, like the Anglican way of doing it, was a practical innovation rather than a. I thought it might have been a switch to move away from the doctrine a little bit to try to just create some distance after they left. But it's interesting that it's a practical innovation. My actual question is not about the chanting. I was reflecting a little bit this week about the Gatha of Atonement and thinking about how, in my day-to-day life, surely there are times where I am inflicting negative karma on others. But more often than not, it's inflicted on myself. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on the relationship between kind of like that sort of view of negative karma, like thinking about how we do it to ourselves sometimes and not just to each other. And then also, and how that, either in terms of how it relates to the Gotham Atonement or other practices about atonement in quotation marks. You could speak on that, that'd be great.
Let's see, the Gatha of Atonement. Something that we chant on Sundays before we get into the rest of the chanting service. And that is actually something that we do because I have spent so much time out of Great Vow, which is my Zumi Roshi lineage. So if you go to Dharma Rain, you won't hear it. So our forms here in many ways are kind of a kludge of Dharma Rain and Dharma Cloud lineage and the Great Vow lineage. So the Gatha of Atonement, which somebody pointed out to me recently, is, I mean, I guess I knew, but is different in the page that we use for chanting it on Sundays than it is in the precepts, which we are reciting now on Tuesdays. So the Gatha of Atonement is also there, where it says in the precepts, it's all my past and harmful karma. Born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And the one that we chant on Sunday, all harmful karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, I now atone for it all. So, I mean, that's obviously the same verse, but slightly different wording. Yeah, in terms of, I mean, I guess I would ask you what, I mean, when it comes to this, what's the difference between hurting somebody else and hurting yourself? I mean, you can be sorry for hurting yourself, right? Although, I mean, maybe that's a, yeah, that's actually probably an important Dharma gate for many of us to go through. It reminds me of, the practice of metta and being able to turn metta or goodwill toward ourselves and how difficult that can actually be. That when we think of goodwill, oh yes, I want goodwill for you and you and you, but goodwill for myself, okay, only once I've improved, only once I've done this, only once I've, so that, yeah, turning it toward ourselves can be very difficult. and feeling like, I mean, the Gotha Atonement, and the whole that whole piece of the precept practice and our practice, I feel is like leaping beyond blame. And so we're kind of disidentifying with even our past self and actions, even though we're taking responsibility for the repercussions of what we've done. We're not, we're looking at it kind of in a kind of detached way. So you could almost just see yourself. Here's the self that, caused harm, and here's the self that felt the harm. And oh, that's really too bad. I don't know if I'm getting at what you're asking though, but yeah. James.
Not related to the gatha at all, but in going back to the idea of the precepts, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm kind of thinking about when I give my precepts talk in a couple months. But it occurred to me, and I don't know why it hadn't occurred to me before, that the because in the Theravadin tradition, they only do the five precepts, the grave, what we would call the grave precepts, and then we have these the Bodhisattva. We've got all these additional precepts. I'm like, huh? It's like the first thing you got to do is stop hurting other people. Like, you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie. You stop the outflows towards others, and then you can start to work on yourself. And I thought it was very interesting how those later precepts really seem to be more about like my own internal relationship with myself, and to the degree that that then impacts how I might interact with others. But it's mostly about just, healing my own things. But I got to do the grave precepts first, and at least stop pushing harm out onto others as well. So that turning in the precepts of just that turning from the outward to the inward has been a really interesting thing that I've been mulling over. So I do whatever, however that intersects with people's question and what you just said.
Well, it does make me think of something my teachers would emphasize, that in our practice, our Mahayana practice, it's like we also have the Hinayana practice, the small vehicle practice, meaning Hinayana is not synonymous with like Theravadin Buddhism, but like Buddhism that is aimed at practice that is aimed at, I mean, for lack of a better word, self-improvement. It's aimed at changing your behaviors, reducing suffering, gaining some kind of control over your mind and body and whatever. So that kind of real literal practice. And then you get to Mahayana, which is like, no good and bad, and you have everything you need already and all of this stuff. But if you only just kind of did the Mahayana and you didn't do the Hinayana work, you just, just be fluffy. You'd just be ridiculous, right? So that kind of that almost like they exist together, and they're both important. That so that there is that aspect of the precepts of like as because when we start talking about them, most of us, well, we presume anyway when we're together that most of us have our lives under some semblance of control, and we're not murdering people, and we're not going out and stealing stuff, and we're not, raping people. We're not like, committing mass fraud. We're not, well, I mean, it's probably not as valid to assume that we're not abusing intoxicants, right? There could be some of us who do have that problem. So, that when we start to talk about the precepts, we tend to immediately go to something that's a little more subtle, right? Like when you're stealing time, and when I'm working and I don't fully account for my time, I'm kind of stealing from my employer. And like it's, so we get to this more subtle aspects of it. But at the base, it is just like you cannot do spiritual practice if you are just making a karmic mess out of your life and hurting people and yourself. And there's that. I always love that. aspect of the precepts, which is like they describe how things work. They don't describe the rules that some God set for us. They describe how things work so that if somebody kills, for instance, or breaks one of these precepts and gets away with it, they don't. Right? I mean, there's yeah. They it has impacts on themselves as well. Like the thief looks behind the door, right? Ruth Ann, did you have something you wanted to add?
Oh no, sorry.
Okay,
I
no
just coughed and bumped my phone.
problem. Just wanted to check. All right, well, that brings us to 12:15. Wonderful. Offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Oh, and if you ever wonder, like, what the heck is that thing we say? So this is something that I've been conscious of lately, of like, most of the things that we do are pretty explained. And then every once in a while, we just like, just put our hands like this and say something. So, I mean, we could perhaps have the cloud host, but they'd have to be really like up on it. They'd have to be really ready to drop that in the chat. But that is the universal dedication, which is on page 2 of the chant book. And basically, you don't have to, I don't think you have to be around that long before you learn it, just because we say it all the time. So anyway.